Well, good evening, everyone. And I want to commend you people in the Zendo for getting to the Zendo tonight, because at about 6:30 tonight, it was reported that here in Roberts Creek, it was bucketing down. So good for you. I'm warm and cozy in my house. So tonight, I am talking about right relationship in intimate relationships. And I'm going to start with a quote from Charlotte Joko Beck, who was an American Zen teacher, who is well known for her two books, one which is Everyday Zen, and the other one is called Nothing Special. She was a student of Maizumi Roshi. She received Dharma transmission from him in 1978 and went on to establish the Zen Center San Diego in 1983. She died in 2011. And I really love this book. I've had it for a long time. And it's definitely a book that I put on a, you know, Zen Buddhist reading list. And she is a teacher I really would like to have met. So this is from the chapter entitled Relationships Don't Work. No matter where you go, people are people. They are all wonderful and they are all troubled, as people are everywhere. And the same questions plague Australians as plague us. She was just coming back from a teaching stint in Australia. They have just as much difficulty with relationships as we do. So I want to talk for a few minutes about the illusions we have that relationships are going to work. See, they don't. They simply don't work. There never was a relationship that worked. You may say, well, why are we doing all this practice if that's true? It's the fact that we want something to work that makes our relationships so unsatisfactory. In a way, life can work, but not coming from the standpoint that we are going to do something that will make it work. In everything we do in relation to other people, there is a subtle or not so subtle expectation. We think, somehow I'm going to figure this out, this relationship out, and make it work. And then I will get what I want. We all want something from the people we are in relationship to. None of us can say we don't want something from those we are in relationship to. And even if we avoid relationships, that's another way of wanting something. So relationships just don't work. Ouch. So what Joko Beck is pointing to is that if we approach our relationships from our ego, we are coming from a place of desire and aversion, wanting this and not wanting that. That just doesn't work very well. So now I'm going to tell you a personal story. About a year ago, I was going through a very difficult time with my relationship with my partner. We had just moved into a new-to-us house, and I had quite a bit of resentment and anger around how this move came about. I actually felt somewhat bullied into this move, as my partner did not want to stay where we were and had found a house that he became enthralled with. And if you have ever moved, you know how traumatic that whole process can be. Being in the middle of a pandemic probably did not help either. To be honest, I was really shocked at how traumatized I was by this move. I really felt quite discombobulated and saw in a painful way that I really don't like change. That's a whole other talk, I guess. It was a stressful time for both of us, but what really caused a rift was an incident in the new house where my partner reacted very negatively to a house painter who came for a consult. Without going into the gory details, too much information, I became very upset, angry, and really embarrassed about his behavior. And I actually gave him an ultimatum several days later when I could talk to him that I would not tolerate that kind of behavior and if it happened again. And if that happened again, I would leave. He apologized for his behavior, but indicated to me that he did not think it was a big deal and that we could just move on. Huh. I was definitely not feeling the same way, and I was feeling deeply shocked and angry. And the next 6 weeks were very difficult for me as I wrestled with the question, do I stay in this relationship? I did seek help and clarity from local therapists, whose main suggestion was to talk to my partner, as communication was not happening much at this time. I was ambivalent enough about the relationship that I kept many of the moving boxes in case I needed them again soon. Probably the most helpful advice was from Patricia, who I've known for more than 30 years and has been a mentor and a guide for me. She does readings based on energy and vibration. And I know that sounds quite airy-fairy, but she's very gifted, and through her work is able to help one see what's underneath the surface emotions and issues. And I knew she would have a very different view and approach from conventional therapy. She did not disappoint. So after listening patiently to my tale of woe, she helped me to relax physically and energetically so that I was not feeling so tense and wound up. Then she pointed out that the move and the instigating event was over and done, so I needed to stop fueling the resentment and anger. And then she pointed out that this triggering of each other's pain and wounds is what our partners do for us. They give us something to work with. Arg. Because of our close relationship and proximity, we trigger one another both consciously and unconsciously, which gives us the opportunity to try and meet that pain with love and compassion. So when I'm feeling triggered and in pain, if I can't meet that moment or emotion with love, can I at least soften towards it, at least not get re-triggered by it and not continue that cycle of anger and resentment or whatever other emotions are present. This is difficult to do. Patricia acknowledged that this was not an easy job, and she said, I quote, "This is the hardest thing that you will ever do. It is very much part of the spiritual path for me." She went on to lament about how easily we humans shut down, push away, repress, rather than choose love and compassion. And the longer I'm alive on this planet, the more I keep being told and hearing that loving each other is really what we're here for. And I'm not just talking about intimate relationships, but our relationships with each other, our family, our friends, work colleagues, communities, nature, the world. When I protested that I felt I needed a partner who was more compatible with me, someone who I could talk to about shared interests, and someone who I thought was interested in a spiritual path, Patricia actually laughed at me and responded, "Sure, the personality would like that, but then you wouldn't be challenged." And being challenged helps us develop patience and love. It helps us to heal and to grow. Some years ago, I went to a teaching given by Pema Chodron. She was teaching on Shanti Deva's The Way of the Bodhisattva, specifically the chapter on patience. She had a great story about Atisha, who was an Indian spiritual teacher who was invited to Tibet to teach, and he brought with him his crabby, irascible, obstreperous tea boy. Now, why would he want to do that? Because he had heard that the Tibetan people were so kind and happy, and that he knew that in order for him to continue to develop his spiritual practice and to develop patience specifically, he needed someone who would provoke him. This was his Bengali tea boy. Pema Chodron went on to say that we should be very grateful for people like this in our life because they help us develop patience. One day, it struck me that I had my own Bengali tea boy in my partner, who can be very impatient, hypercritical, and has a short fuse at times. So my practice, if I'm willing to do it, is to appreciate him for being who he is and to meet his behavior and words with some amount of equanimity. At least can I not strike back with my own anger, hurt, harsh words? Can I soften towards the negative feelings brought up on myself? And then can I soften towards the situation and even towards him? This is not always easy to do. And I know I frequently fall down, but there is always the next opportunity to practice choosing love. And even to have the concept of kindness, softness, love directed towards myself in this situation is helpful. It counts. This really is a wonderful opportunity to practice, even though I don't always feel this way. So many thanks to my own Bengali tea boy. When I mentioned my Bengali tea boy to Patricia, she responded with, "The world is our Bengali tea boy." So even if you don't have a spouse or partner, rest assured that life will find a way to produce a Bengali tea boy or girl for you to practice with. A family member who pushes your buttons, or a very irritable work colleague, or a friend that often says hurtful things. Just remember, these people are giving you a treasure. They are helping you to practice with developing patience and kindness and love. And it was pointed out to me that if I am to deepen my compassion and work in this life, this sometimes prickly relationship makes me do my work. This being human can be an incredibly challenging dimension to be in and to grow in. We are shown that our relationship with love is this much, and our relationship with all of the crap, the ego-based pain, is this much. We very quickly react to a trigger with our own fear and anger, rather than meeting that moment with some openness and softness. But in order to grow and heal, we need to continually value love more than the discomfort that arises, to value love because that discomfort is arising. And even though we will fall down, we just need to get back up and keep choosing kindness, softness, love, whatever works for you. Patricia told me, it's impossible to do this wrong. So when you find yourself being triggered by something or someone, realize that this is happening. Stop, breathe, and then see if you can offer to yourself some softness or kindness that this is happening, that you feel anger or fear or shame. It has to start with ourselves. And it was pointed out to me that I was not with myself in a loving, kind way, but that I expected my partner to be that for me, to fulfill me. And this will not work, as our Zen ancestor, Joku Beck, has pointed out. We need to be our own best friend. And to repeat, just having the concept or idea of offering softness or kindness or love to the situation, yourself, and the other person is helpful. Some months ago, I was listening to an interview with Jill Bolte Taylor, who is a neuroscientist who at the age of 37 in 1996 had a massive stroke. And she recovered from it, but it took her 8 years. She gave a TED talk about her experience, which I would highly recommend watching, because she recounts in detail what happened inside her brain during and after the stroke. And what she learned both as a stroke survivor and a neuroscientist. The TED conference where she presented was dedicated to the big questions. And the question of that conference was, who am I? And here are the closing remarks of her TED talk. Who are we? We are the life force power of the universe with manual dexterity and two cognitive minds. We have the power to choose moment by moment who and how we want to be in the world. Right here, right now, I can step into the consciousness of my right hemisphere. Where we are, I am the life force power of the universe. I am the life force power of the 50 trillion beautiful molecular geniuses that make up my form, one with all that is. Or I can choose to step into the consciousness of my left hemisphere, where I become a single individual, a solid, separate, from the flow and separate from you. I am Dr. Jill Bolte Taylor, intellectual neuroanatomist. These are the we inside of me. Which would you choose? Which do you choose? And when? I believe that the more time we spend choosing to run the deep inner peace circuitry of our right hemisphere, the more peace we will project into the world and the more peaceful our planet will be. And I thought that this was an idea worth spreading. Taylor also wrote a book called The Stroke of Insight, which takes you through her stroke and recovery. And just this year, she has authored another book called Whole Brain Living, which I've been reading over the past 6 weeks or so, and I'm currently reading it for the second time. It's a how-to of how you can learn to work with your thoughts, emotions, and behavior from a brain perspective. And although I really did not intend to use the material for this book in a Dharma talk, what I discovered in this book is that it accords with what we believe in the world of Dharma practice. To me, it confirms scientifically what so many wise teachers have been saying for years about how we get triggered and then tend to react. So indulge me while we look at some neuroanatomy. I nearly had was trying to show a picture of a brain, but I thought that might be a bit much. So the brain is divided into two hemispheres, on the right and left sides. And each hemisphere is an emotional center and a thinking center. The emotional center is deeper in the brain and is more primitive. And the thinking center occupies a place in the cortex of the brain, which is closer to the surface. These two hemispheres are very different from each other in how they process information. And this is what she has to say about that. Underlying the functional differences between our two hemispheres are neurons that process information in unique ways. For example, the neurons in our left brain function linearly. They take an idea, compare that idea to the next idea, and then compare the byproduct of those ideas to the next idea. Therefore, our left brain has the ability to think sequentially. For example, we know that we need to start the engine before we put the car in gear. Our left hemisphere is an amazing serial processor that not only creates abstract linearity, as in 1 + 1 = 2, but manifests for us temporality, the linear sense of time, whereby we can separate past, present, and future. Our right brain cells are not at all designed to create linear order. Instead, our right hemisphere functions like a parallel processor, bringing in multiple streams of data that simultaneously reveal a single complex moment of experience. Our right brain manifests a rich composite of the right here, right now, present moment by adding depth to the creation of our memories, which are influenced by both of our hemispheres. So as I just read to you, these two hemispheres include a thinking center and an emotional center. And it's interesting to note that the emotional centers are located deeper in the brain and are older. They're more primitive parts of our brain that we share with all animals. The thinking centers located in the cortex are more superficial, as I mentioned, and they're layered on top of these more primitive emotional centers. There are four distinct neuroanatomical areas in these two hemispheres. Taylor refers to these four areas as characters, so I will use this term as well. Character one being the left thinking center, character two being the left emotional center, character three is the right emotional center, and character four is the right thinking center. I hope you're still with me. So I'd like to focus on the emotional center of character two, which is located in the left hemisphere. This side of the brain is concerned with past and future. is analytical, discriminative, and ego-based. And the job of our character two is to receive incoming stimuli and decide if we are in danger based on past information. And if so, should we fight, flee, or freeze? This is the alarm center of our brain. And because of the bias of the left brain, character two tends to keep score, is critical, and fear-based. This is where we get into trouble. So when our spouse or significant other, or anyone else for that matter, says something to us that triggers our anger or a past hurt, well, that is this part of the brain being activated, our character two. And what should we do when that happens? Taylor instructs us to breathe, to give ourselves some space and to calm down. And then we recognize what we're feeling and experiencing, then we appreciate what this character two is trying to do, which is to protect us, to keep us safe. And the interesting thing is that if we can just be present with the emotion, it will dissipate in 90 seconds. This is what Taylor has to say about this. Once the circuit is stimulated and we have triggered an emotional response, it takes less than 90 seconds for the chemistry of that emotion to flood through us and then flush completely out of our bloodstream. Of course, we can either consciously or unconsciously choose to rethink the thought that triggered the emotional circuit to run and stay hurt, angry, sad, or whatever for longer than 90 seconds. But in that case, what we're doing at a neurological level is re-stimulating the emotional circuit so it will run over and over again. If there is no repeated trigger, the emotional circuit will run its course and stop after the 90 seconds that it takes for the chemistry to neutralize. I call this the 90-second rule. Taylor has developed something that she calls the brain huddle, which after the first steps of breathe, recognize, appreciate, goes on to inquiry, which involves inviting all the four characters into a huddle to determine what to do next, because they will all have a different perspective, and then navigating a solution based on these four characters of the left thinking and emotional centers and the right thinking and emotional centers. The acronym that is made up from all these steps is BRAIN, breathing, recognition, appreciation, inquiry, and navigation. This is not different, really, from how we as Zen practitioners can work with our mind. When we're triggered, we can also breathe, recognize what is happening. That is, recognize that we are angry or afraid or hurt, and let the wave of emotion pass. Remember that 90-second rule? And appreciate, which is being offered, whatever kind of softness, kindness, or love that you can muster to the situation and to ourselves. The inquiry of Taylor's brain huddle is to inquire internally and to invite the other brain characters into the huddle, and the navigation part is to come up with a way out of the conflict or situation from these four characters. And I apologize that I can't get into more detail about the other characters. So you're getting kind of a bit of a skewed sense of them, because I'm really talking about one of them, because they're all quite unique. So what's really struck me is how this parallels how we work with relationships as Zen practitioners. Our Zen meditation sets us up to access that place that allows us to respond rather than react. So inviting in that spaciousness, that part of us that is connected to something bigger, and that corresponds to character four, the thinking center of our right brain. And then the navigation part, which she talks about, would be coming from this more spacious and grounded place, and, you know, maybe to talk to the other person and resolve the conflict if that's needed. But again, our Zen meditation practice really is a training for this kind of work, or how we can deal with a conflict. It hones our awareness. It allows us to be present with uncomfortable emotions, and also having the patience to let them pass through. And then we can also open up to that spaciousness of the present moment. And from that calmer, bigger space, we can then again offer some or more kindness, more softness, more love, whatever you can muster or manage to ourselves, to the situation, and to the other person. As I mentioned, this character too is where we get into trouble with our relationships. So when my partner says something that I perceive as hurtful or critical, I'm triggered and I may react. I feel hurt and anger, and then I may react out of that. Now, at that point, I'm in my character too, and if I don't take steps to choose otherwise, I will likely react by saying something hurtful back, and we just end up throwing mud at one another, relatively speaking, and making things worse. The interesting thing about this part of the brain is that it, again, and I mentioned this, it is a more primitive area. But the other thing that's interesting is it doesn't evolve. This is a part of the brain that doesn't change. So we can have temper tantrums from the time we're born to the time we die. And this is what Taylor has to say about character two. It is our left brain emotional character too, who screams, wails, and rages against all those injustices that it has perceived as hurtful, dangerous, or unfair. It also holds us back, flees, or freezes when something triggers our fear. Over the years, it has been the job of this tender and vulnerable character to hold our past pain in memory for our future protection. And another interesting thing I learned about character two is it does not take responsibility for its actions, which I found kind of interesting. And it fits in with that idea that it's a part of the brain that always stays kind of immature. And again, that necessitates needing to step out of this character to resolve any conflict. And indeed, this is the only way that conflict can be resolved between two people who are stuck in their character twos, their ego-based emotional centers. It can be a place of really being stuck. And we can appreciate why this scenario, if it becomes a pattern, can eventually lead to a breakdown of a relationship, separation, divorce. Ultimately, we have a choice of how we want to respond to our lives, and more specifically, to what triggers us emotionally. This is Dr. Taylor again. We have the power to turn our emotional circuitry on and off by choice. In fact, the same principle underlying our body's neurological reflexes, like the kick our knee will give when our patella tendon is tapped with a reflex hammer, remains in play when an emotional circuit is triggered and we reflexly respond with fear, anger, or hostility. Just remember that we have the choice as to how we respond to being triggered. And that's helpful to know, that we don't have to be helpless victims that keep that cycle of pain, anger, and fear going, and that undermine our intimate relationships. But we need also to cut ourselves some slack, because it turns out that we are hardwired this way according to neuroscience. And we need to offer some kindness to ourselves because of that. I wanted to give the last words to our Zen ancestor, Joko Beck. As we endeavor to practice with relationships, we begin to see that they are our best way to grow. In them, we can see what our mind, our body, our senses, and our thoughts really are. Why are relationships such excellent practice? Why do they help us go into what we might call the slow death of the ego? Because aside from our formal sitting, there is no way that is superior to relationships and helping us see where we're stuck and what we're holding on to. As long as our buttons are pushed, we have a great chance to learn and grow. So a relationship is a great gift, not because it makes us happy, it often doesn't, but because any intimate relationship, if we view it as practice, is the clearest mirror we can find. My personal experience is that this is really true. So thank you for listening. And I apologize. I realized that when I was reading the talk, I had done an edited version more recently, and for some reason I printed out a slightly older version, which kind of threw me. Oh, well.